Thank you. Pleasure to meditate with you, and hopefully my talking wasn't a disturbance. So, in a certain way, we might already be able to see how meditation creates a space from which action can blossom. But even though it may be quite obvious, there's also many, many ways, in many, many shapes in which that can unfold. And for as much as it can be useful, we would like to share a little bit about how we became involved in the activism movement in Israel and Palestine, particularly. Not too much background in the talk section, perhaps. Just enough to kind of tell the story. And if you have any particular questions, we're hoping to keep a good chunk of time at the end, and also happy to for you to share your own experiences, what you're interested in. Can also be interesting for each other to have this have a chance to maybe network ideas, also hear about people who are interested in something and other people might want to get involved. So, has anyone ever been to Palestine from here? Or, yeah? Great. Okay. So I'll just give like a brief background. That obviously the Palestinian situation is reasonably well known. It's a little bit of a hit in the media every once in a while. It's a very violent situation many times. The way we experience it, we would say that the Palestinian people are being persecuted in a number of ways from a number of factors in the society of Israel and Palestine. One very obvious way is that they're persecuted by the policies of the Israeli government, which are policies of separation. Also, a lot of the laws and the rules that are coming out there seem to be directly aimed at making life intolerable for them as a people. The expansion of the illegal by international law, the Israeli settlements in the lands of the Palestinian people, and the impact that that has on their freedom of movement, access to their lands, and the general sense of just a general sense of disrespect and hardship that comes from that. The very simple presence of the Israeli occupying force in the area causes an element of fear and difficulty, and sometimes the direct actions of the Israeli occupying force there, arresting children and adults for minor offences and trialing them in a military court for which they have no representative. And of course they're also affected by the corruption of their own government, taking international aid and support and also running the economy in a way which doesn't always have the best interests of the people at heart, which is a little bit worse than what we might feel about our own governments and the way that they often are perhaps fulfilling their own ambitions rather than that of the people. So, just to kind of be quite brief about it, that affects the life in the olive groves, which is one place where we do a lot of the direct action of the retreats that we lead. So obviously in their access to their land, especially near the settlements and roads, fear of violence when they access their olive groves, or in fact, a radical lack of permits. Radical means maybe a handful of days in which they can actually access their trees, which any of us who have a general sense of how agriculture works, farmers normally work most of their lives around their crops, so that makes it very, very difficult. And direct damage to the trees from settlers and sometimes others. Another area where we're involved, but it's not part of the retreat itself, is in supporting healthcare. Healthcare is a very important element in modern life. It's difficult often to see doctors visiting in hospitals, and when they need care, maybe across the border into Israel, we can help with getting permits for patients and families, or just giving lifts because they can't bring their cars through. Also looking for creative ways to support incomes for people who are living in occupation and getting working permits if they can. And currently we're involved in trying to fund further education for the youth in Palestine, either in vocational trainings or higher education. And we're kind of midway setting up something that's going to be called the Spring Up Foundation to hopefully kind of raise money for that. But what we want to speak about primarily today is one longer retreat that we do there in October during the olive harvesting time. So picking the olives, pressing the olives, making the oil, which is a significant part of the
livelihood.
Yes.
And culture.
Great. So I was going to do the more eloquent speaking in the second part of the because she's not a native English speaker, she doesn't struggle so much with the language. So our retreat then is called Being Peace, because as you pointed out, you know, a lot of activism can kind of come from this space of a certain antagonism, And so what became very clear for us was that if we could actually be peace while also working for peace, which kind of chimes in with a quote which is attributed to Gandhi, of be the change you wish to see in the world. So if you want peace in the world, then you have to be peace in the world, and that's the way that it can manifest and come about. If we want harmony in the world, if we want unity in the world, we can't say, I want unity with everyone but not you. You know, kind of, it doesn't work in that sense. So if we're working for that, that needs to kind of come through in the way that we work. So kind of keeping an eye on the goal as we work for something. So in this case, being peace, which means coming there and actually being first-hand witnesses, bearing witness to the situation. It means sympathetically and empathetically hearing the pain and struggle of the people there, which I think if we've ever been in a situation where we've really just had to share our experience with someone else, we know that there is just real value in getting to express, getting to share. And even if we're not able to change something, there's something really valuable in that listening. And of course, it can also lead to direct aid, like I was mentioning in the healthcare scenario, or helping people get work permits. But just that sense of, like, we do care, the world does care. You know, we do want this information to get out, and we will help that to come across. And we do all of that combining meditation so that we're kind of developing that sense of being peace on the cushion or in isolation within, cultivating that quality, and then bringing that into action. And we also organize shorter activities, weekend retreats. Primarily, so that longer retreat is open to you guys if you want to come across and participate in it. And we do shorter activities directly for Israelis or people who are already in the area. And there's a real culture of separation in Israel, that, you know, you need to be afraid of your neighbours and you know, there's no opportunities to intermix. That's kind of from the Israeli side, and from the Palestinian side, there's a movement which is called anti-normalisation. Like, hey, don't act like this is normal. Like, you can't just be friends with your occupier, just even if they really happen to be a really beautiful, charming human being with good intentions, they're your occupier. Don't get involved. So we know many Palestinians in villages, and we bring Israelis who are interested in meeting their neighbours out for weekend activities, and it's not about normalisation, it's about radical transformation of the situation. And primarily it's about meeting your neighbours, getting to know them as equals, as friends. so that we can develop meaningful connections of support, solidarity, and really of friendship. You know, because society is a collective of people. So, you know, governments can have a policy, armies can make actions, but eventually it boils down to if we can be human, if we can bring humanity to the fore. Is it time for me to mention who we work with? Yeah. So, when we bring our actions into play, we very much ask for leadership from the villagers. You know, we're not coming with our own ideal of what this situation should be. So we ask the Palestinian villagers, you know, what work needs to be done, if they're interested in meeting Israelis, and if they are, in what way, and what do you want to get interacted with, what work needs to be done in the village. We're also involved, there's other Israeli groups, like a sister organization to us called Engage Dharma, who does very similar projects. There's also the Rabbis for Human Rights. I don't know if anyone's heard of this organization. So they're rabbis in the Jewish tradition, but very well organized and interested in having both one foot in the society as a voice. Rabbis have a clear voice of authority for moral issues and cultural issues, but also not giving, but not holding back from real kind of radical liberty of human rights for all. Understanding that, you know, if you're a voice for God, for religion, as they understand it, you know, you have a responsibility to stand up for that which doesn't fit in within that. They also have a legal team and direct actions and involvement with the army, as communication with the army, but also taking direct actions. If both the legal team don't get the result, they'll still take a direct action if it's illegal, and if the army says you can't go somewhere, they'll fight it right to the end and perhaps still go. So they're very...
Get arrested.
They're real bodhisattvas of the situation. They're tirelessly working, and people, you know, it doesn't feel right not to mention when we talk about the work we do.
Is it violent action or...?
No. No, it's very non-violent action, but very... direct and
non-violent, as in standing in front of bulldozers that are about to demolish a Palestinian home. So it's not violent, but you still get arrested for it.
Okay. So there are many organizations all kind of working through different ways and different means, and my personal view is there's not all of these ways I even agree with. The ones I've mentioned are, and many more organisations that we work with are, and happy to give you a list of places to look out, websites to get involved with, or people to volunteer with. But perhaps every action is an important action. The direct actions, the peaceful actions, the work in the courts, the work with the army, the work with the youth before they enter the army, they're all really kind of important actions to work for human rights and liberty. So Zara's going to speak a bit more about how we bring meditation as a kind of a deep and wide foundation for our action, a support for our ongoing action so that we don't give up, and also a new way for action to express itself while coming from meditation. And then we'll have time for some questions.
So I'd like to carry on from what Nathan was saying and speak a little bit more about this relationship between Dharma practice. Everyone familiar with the word Dharma? Please feel free to say if you're not. Like, really important that we're all flowing together. So the relationship between Dharma and social engagement, which is kind of what the theme of the evening is, and go into more detail about this. So just like the Buddha's first noble truth, the kind of first step in this exploration is actually acknowledging and facing the fact that there is suffering in our world. Yeah, there's suffering for ourselves personally, and there's suffering in the world around us. And the real question becomes, how do we address that? How do we live with that? How do we open to that? if we do nothing, nothing is going to change. You know, that's kind of one thing to look at. If we do nothing, nothing is going to change. And I recently read a beautiful story. Some people here were just on the trekking retreat we taught, so they heard it, but they'll hear it again. Of one of an American teacher in our tradition who was traveling in Tibet, and she came across some monks who were rebuilding their monastery that was that had been destroyed by the Chinese authorities. And she hung out with them a bit and spoke to them, and she said to them, well, you know, so what happened? And they explained that the monastery had been destroyed and now they'd been given permission to rebuild it, so they were rebuilding it. And she said, well, what guarantee have you got that it won't get destroyed again? And they said, none. But if we don't rebuild it, it will never be rebuilt. So that kind of attitude towards suffering in our world, which is, we don't know that we can fix it. We don't know that we can solve it. We don't know that what we do will have a certain result or will not be undone. But if we don't do something, if we don't address, then nothing will happen. That we do know. And so having that kind of motivation to just do what we can without necessarily having the expectation from ourselves to fix, to solve everything. Another aspect that Dharma practice can really support in social engagement, in acting to alleviate suffering, is to help with burnout issues. Any of us who have kind of followed the world of social engagement, whether it's our professional work, I mean, it can be in healthcare, it can be in education, it can be in any form of direct action. There's a lot of burnout out there, a lot of burnout, a lot of overwhelm. And so Dharma practice can really support us with that, and I'll speak more about that, about how that works. And then that question, which we've already touched on a few times, of how do we address issues of that are challenging in our world without creating more separation? Yeah, without creating more us and them, without creating more good and bad. And that's a real, that's a deep Dharma question for us. And the Dharma has answers, but it's also a deep exploration. You know, how do we do that? It's really important to remember when we contemplate Dharma, when we contemplate our spiritual path, that action or ethics is a really important part of the path. You know, so often, especially in the West, especially in our cultures, when we practice, we primarily practice meditation. But meditation is only one part of the path that the Buddha taught. You know, probably many of you have heard of the Eightfold Path. So we taught a path that has eight parts. And these eight parts are divided into three groups. One group is the group of meditation. Another group is the group of wisdom. And the third group is the group of ethics, of ethical conduct, which includes right action or wise action, wise livelihood, and wise speech. So these are all very much areas of action and interaction. And so this isn't this idea of engaged Dharma, of Dharma that interacts, that is engaged with the suffering in the world, isn't a new idea. Sometimes a few years ago, one of our teachers said, even putting engaged before the word Dharma is kind of weird, because Dharma in its nature is about engagement. Yeah, what we're taught is about non-separation. What we're taught is about the impact that our actions have. You know, that we're not separate, that just by being alive, just by breathing, just by eating, just by walking, we affect our environment, our thoughts, our activities, our speech. They all have meaning. And so engaged Dharma, engaged Buddhism, whichever way we call it, is not a new idea. It's actually at the root, at the basis of the practice. And so acknowledging that and exploring what that means in our own lives. What that means in our own lives. How do we actually put that into practice? So Dharma practice and meditation practice can be a foundation for our social engagement in the world. It can be an inspiration. You know, for us very much, there was that sense of cultivation of compassion, of loving kindness, of equanimity, all these qualities, generosity, that we cultivate when we're practicing. And then the wish to actually bring them into action in the world. And so it can be an inspiration, a sense of, or a moment of realizing some aspect of non-self or non-separation, interconnectedness, and feeling that care for others that can really inspire us to act. The cultivation of qualities like wisdom, clear seeing, compassion, equanimity, generosity, like patience, all these are real qualities that are resources for us in our lives. And so meditation or Dharma practice can also be a real support, a real resource against burnout, that can help us with burnout, with overwhelm, with a sense of sometimes despair also that we have. You know, we look at the state of the world, we look at the state of the environment, we look at the state of the climate, we look at the state of our politics, and we can just feel despair. You know, what can I do? This little thing. You know, just me. How can I bring change? And then the teachings come and they say, of course we can bring change. Because this world is created out of all of us. And everything that we do has an effect. So our actions really matter. Our priorities really matter. They have an effect. And the support of practice can be a real refuge for us. So we have a place to come back to. We have a place to re-nourish, to reconnect, to re-root. Both in the moment, yeah, both when we are in difficult situations, and I'm going to start giving examples soon. Hopefully it will be a bit more alive. And in formal practice. So as Nathan was saying, we'll talk particularly about the Being Peace retreat, but not on all of our meditation and action retreats, we have formal meditation times where we can really come in and feel, what is going on? How do I reconnect to my resources? How do I make space? How do I bring metta, kindness, towards myself also? And it can also be a real resource in the moment while we're in difficult situations. So one example of this from some of our work, so it was a few years ago when we were visiting in Israel and Palestine, and we were at a checkpoint. We were about to pick up some Palestinian friends of ours with their 9-year-old girl, a daughter who was coming into Israel to receive chemotherapy treatments. She had quite severe bone cancer in her leg. And as Nathan mentioned briefly, Palestinians, whenever their health issues are more complex, like cancer or any kind of disease that needs more complex health care, they don't have the facilities within Palestine. So they have to come into Israel to receive the treatment. The Palestinian Authority still pays for it, but the actual treatment is within Israel, which means they need to get permits. They need to get from the checkpoints to the hospitals. Now, these checkpoints are checkpoints for Palestinians only, which means that there's no public transport. So a family, in this case parents with their 9-year-old child, having to come in to get chemotherapy at least twice a month, are in a situation where they can get as far as the checkpoint if a relative drops them off. They cross the checkpoint, and then their only way of getting from the checkpoint to the hospital, which is about an hour, at least an hour's drive away, is a taxi. Incredibly expensive, or Israelis coming to pick them up and taking them to the hospital. So we're in the situation to pick up the family. And this was a specific situation because, again, any Palestinian who needs to cross a checkpoint, whether it's for work purposes or to receive medical treatment, has to cross in the same checkpoint. So this family was in a situation where they would have to cross the checkpoint along with about 200 workers. So standing in a queue sometimes for 1 hour, 2 hours, with a little girl who can't even stand, let alone walk, but is 9 years old. Really incredible weight for the parents to carry. And so some of our Israeli friends had arranged that they would cross at a different checkpoint at which they could drive to the gate, get off, and we would, Israeli friends would wait on the other side and they could just walk a few steps and get into the Israeli car. And this was the only second time that this was happening. So we arrived early to make sure that by the time the Palestinian family arrived, it was all organized, the soldiers would be at the gate, they would open the gate and they could get through to make it as easy as possible. So we arrived early, we parked the car. Nathan stayed in the car and I went to speak to the soldiers. It was a Sunday morning in Israel. That's the beginning of the week, Sunday. Sunday morning, about 8 o'clock, a couple of young Israeli women soldiers, maybe 19, 18 years old, had spent their weekend on duty. So they weren't very happy. And I came and explained to them what we were there to do, and I asked them if they had gotten the information from their superiors that this was happening and the gate needed to be opened. And they said no. And so I asked them to please contact their command center, because I knew that the orders were there. And they were just uninterested. And so there I was, standing with them, and there they were. And they were uninterested, just uninterested, yeah? So not being rude, not being mean, not being aggressive, but just being uninterested, disinterested. And in that moment, action needed to be done, yeah? But before the action, here's where Dharma practice comes. Before the action, feeling what is happening inside. So standing there, feeling the feet on the ground, feeling the body, feeling the emotions, feeling the walls starting to build up. Yeah, me against you. I'm a good person, you're a bad person. Feeling the walls starting to build up. Looking around me at the checkpoint, which is all walls and barriers and separation. And so then the clear voice came within, I will not be your enemy. For me towards them, I didn't say it, but it came very clearly inside. I will not be your enemy. This place does not need more enmity. It doesn't need more walls. It doesn't need more separation. It doesn't need more hatred. So I just stood present. I asked them again to phone their command, and I phoned my contacts at the same time. But that moment was really crucial, and that's the moments of refuge. That's where we can stay steady and not give in to the forces of hatred and of separation that naturally arise in these situations for us. So that's one example. So coming from meditation practice, coming from this deep-rootedness in Dharma practice, can really offer us new ways of acting, in situations that are really, really challenging. This idea that Nathan was speaking about of being peace, of bringing that which we're cultivating on the cushion into reality, and to really see that as a practice. So like I was saying, I will not be your enemy. Bringing that into the situations, which both helps me in this case to stay grounded, to stay centered, but also creates a different atmosphere and actually in the end can help the other as well. So in that same, I'll just continue with the same story I wasn't intending to originally. But as I was standing with the soldiers there, with those two women soldiers, I was in the contact. They still hadn't moved to do anything. A couple of more soldiers arrived from the main base. They happened to be two guys. And they came over to see what was going on. It was an unusual situation. And I explained to them again. One of them immediately went to make the phone call to check. The other stayed, hung around, and talked to the other soldiers. And after some time, he came to me and he said, he was kind of joking, and he said, "Oh, I've heard you're here to adopt a Palestinian child." His way of joking. And I looked at him, and again, what's the reaction? You know, the reaction, if I'm putting it very crudely, is kind of, "Fuck you." You know, that's kind of what comes up. How can you make a joke of this? This isn't funny. But the ability to see the reaction and not to believe it, not to identify with it, to let it arise and pass and stay connected to the deeper truth. And so I turned to him and I said, "Actually, no. I'm here to take a little girl to chemotherapy treatments. That's what I'm here to do. Just the truth." And he looked at me, and I looked at him. And then he said to me, "Good on you. Good on you." And so in these moments, the ability to transform the situation and to offer to the other, who may seem like the enemy, the possibility to connect to their own humanity. Because this is just a 19 or 20 year old child who's been put in really difficult circumstances. And we may agree or not agree with his actions and his words, but the possibility to let him connect to his own deeper, truer nature is there if I'm connected to mine, or if we're all connected to ours, actually, because again, it's not mine or yours. So that possibility to embody peace, embody equanimity, embody compassion, embody space, which can then have a real effect. I'll just finish off the story. Again, I wasn't meaning to stay with this one for so long, but to say that by the time it took about, I think, 15 minutes until Marouf and Kausar arrived with their daughter, by the time they arrived at the gate, our car was next to the gate, and as they were driving up, the soldiers ran to the gate to open it and to let them through. And they stood there and watched the father carry his little girl from one car to the other. And after he had placed her as comfortably as possible in the seat, Maouf turned to the soldiers to show them his ID, which he's required to do. And as he was starting to pull it out of the pocket, the soldiers said to him, "No, no, don't bother, just get her to the hospital." And so that kind of is the practice and the effect that is possible for us when we really, really bring this thing that we're cultivating on the cushion together into life. And it's again a gift, not just for ourselves, not just to the people that we're kind of intending to help, but to everyone in the situation. We can see the wider picture. So in any given situation, there's an appropriate action. In any given situation, there is an appropriate action. Sometimes that appropriate action is inaction. You know, sometimes all we can do is just hold our peace. That's the best thing we can do. But there's always an appropriate action. And what that appropriate action is can change, because life is changing. And that's another gift of Dharma practice, that it gives to us in our lives to guide us in our actions. that everything is changing, that everything is conditioned. And so it's not that we find the one true way and that is true permanently. But things change and we have to stay alert, we have to stay awake, just like we do when we practice on the cushion, to find the appropriate response in different situations. Just one more example for this. This was in May, I think, quite recently. We'd come to visit our friends in the Palestinian village that we primarily work with. And in the last, I think since last September, the Israeli authorities are building a security barrier along the, a safety barrier, not security, I shouldn't use the word security in that context, it's confusing. Safety barrier along the roads. The roads are leading to Jewish settlements. And it's just this metal kind of safety barrier that exists everywhere, you know, on either side of the road, so that if a car veers off, it stops against something and doesn't kind of shoot off into the fields. And so they're building these safety barriers, and what's happening as a result is that all the agricultural roads leading into the olive groves are getting blocked because they're building this very, very long, long, long barrier which has no gaps in it. And so despite having had conversations about it before and agreements that there would be breaks in it, the way it was now built, it was completed on one side of the road and being built on the other, there's no breaks, which means that the only way for them to access their olive groves is by foot. So we're talking sacks that weigh sometimes 50 kilos of olives, and try and get that out on foot. Even a donkey or a horse, which is what they've been needing to do in many cases, can't get over this. So the villagers started a weekly demonstration down by the road, and they do it on Friday at the midday prayer. So their way of demonstrating is to hold the midday prayer by the road. Pretty nonviolent. So we came, we were there visiting, so we joined the demonstration along with quite a few other Israeli friends and internationals. And we had just arrived and everything was just beginning, and the jeeps, a couple of jeeps of soldiers arrived to make sure to keep the peace, park just across the road from where we were. And very early on, the young guys of the village, so, you know, the teenagers and the guys in their 20s, started walking towards the actual safety barrier on the side of the road that we were on, and just hung out there, just by this metal barrier. And I could see the soldiers looking at them, and I could see them looking at the soldiers. And I knew that the week before, the soldiers had used tear gas at the demonstration, even though there had been no violence. So I called out to the soldiers in Hebrew, which is my native tongue. This is a non-violent demonstration. There's no reason to use violence. You know, please don't use violence. And I repeated this several times. And some of my Palestinian friends came over and said, you know, why are you talking to them? You know, what did you say? And I explained. It felt quite important to try and diffuse any potential violence from their side if possible. A little while later, one of the young Palestinian men put one leg over the safety barrier and was just sitting on it, straddling in, one leg on each side. So the soldiers called out to him in Hebrew, please move back, move behind the barrier. And I called out to them in English, please speak a language that everyone understands. The villagers, the Palestinians don't understand Hebrew. Speak in a language that everyone understands. The soldier said to me, will you translate for him in Hebrew? And I said, no. You know English. You speak in a language that everyone can understand. So one situation, one action appropriate at one point, another action, and then not appropriate the second time. I hope that example is clear. when to use the Hebrew, when to use the common language, and when to stand the ground for what is supportive of the Palestinians there. So one last point we really wanted to make before making time for questions, and apologies that this is being longer than we were planning, the monologues. So just in the way that our practice, our Dharma practice, our Dharma understanding supports, nourishes, and deepens our possibility to action and to act in the world, it also works the other way. This is really important. So action, engaged action, can also really deepen our practice. So in all of these examples that I've given, there's a real sense of deep, deep practice, deep, deep presence, and deep samadhi. One of my teachers told me a few years ago, he said, samadhi, this word that we hear in Dharma teachings often, and is usually translated as concentration. So we think about it in respect of, in the context of deep meditative states. You know, being in deep samadhi means I'll sit here, I'll be in deep samadhi, I won't hear anything, I won't see anything, nothing will disturb me, I'll be in kind of bliss or whatever we might think. And that's the context for that word. But what it literally means is coming together on the particular. So samadhi means a gatheredness of attention, the ability to bring ourselves to be completely gathered with one particular thing. So a real quality of presence, or we can say a real quality of deep, deep listening to what is going on. And so samadhi doesn't exist only when our eyes are closed on the meditation cushion. This gatheredness can happen in real life situations. And we probably all know them, you know. I don't know if there's any parents here, but probably if there are, and when your child was born, that may have been a time when you felt completely gathered and in the moment. Or women giving birth, you know, really present. And so that non-separation and that mutual enrichment of being, of presence, of equanimity, of friendship, of compassion in action, not just as a quality that we cultivate in action, but in action within really challenging situations. These are moments when we experience the depth of our potential, of what is possible for us, and it really builds our confidence in ourselves and in the path, yeah, and what is possible for us as human beings. On our website, I think we still have this quote. Do we still have the quote from Pema Chodron? Yeah, it's one of our favorite quotes. It's a quote from the Tibetan teacher, Pema Chodron. It's quite appropriate. We're in a Tibetan center. And she says that in our practice, we work on ourselves in order to help others. And also we help others in order to work on ourselves. So it's a real mutual thing. It's a real part of the practice that, like I was saying in the beginning, this idea of engagement is really an inherent part of Dharma teachings. And we need to emphasize it more. We need to emphasize it more. So we'll stop here and hopefully have time. Well, hopefully you'll have questions to make this a bit more interesting. So questions, comments, the space is open and everything is welcome. So even if you're feeling shy, trust yourself and trust in the kind listening of everyone in the space. A good opportunity to practice some right speech.
Well, we started organizing things completely ourselves there in 2006, and have been running it pretty much every year since then. The longer retreat attracts around 15 people, both internationals, is the majority on that, and Israelis coming for as much as they can commit to. And then we run usually about 2 weekends a year, one in the spring, one in the autumn or the fall. And, you know, that again attracts around 10, 15 kind of people. But our sister organization is doing regular weekends. I'm not sure how often they've been.
They do, like Engage Dharma, which like we're also part of, but it's an Israeli organization primarily. They run at least 1 day long or weekend a month, I think, of work days in Palestine. All the stuff that we do is always work-based. Like this, we always do some kind of action. They also do Dharma tours. So where international teachers come to teach in Israel, then they do a Dharma tour. So they'll go and do a international teacher with a busload. Usually for the tours, we get 40, 50 people coming and actually coming to see what's going on in Palestine, because the majority of Israelis actually don't know and don't see it directly. And in the last year and a half, we've now started also organizing that when international teachers come, they also, some of them, we arrange for them to teach a day of meditation in Palestine for Palestinian practitioners. That's a new thing. So there's a lot, and then there's a lot of other activities going on. So like with accompanying families that are coming in for treatments, that's something that's ongoing. So it depends on personal connection mostly. And there's a lot of people involved in that. There's also Israeli NGOs that just do that, by the way. Like there's a lot of, that are not necessarily coming from the Dharma part. Yeah, I think that's the majority of things. And there's Israelis that, like now there's a whole group of Israelis that visit. We work primarily with 2 villages, and there's groups of Israelis that visit regularly these 2 villages. So it can be, like now when there's the weekly demonstration, they come as a group to the demonstrations or during the olive harvest. We have a lot of harvesting days for Israelis then, and you get between 15 to sometimes 40 people coming for a harvest day. And then just regularly, just for friendship, you know, people just come and visit their friends once a month, twice a month. We encourage that a lot because it can't happen the other way around. Palestinians can't go and visit their Israeli friends, so it's the Israelis who need to take the responsibility and the initiative there. Yes, you are.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. It's beautiful. You guys have been doing this for a while, so I'm wondering whether are you seeing, what's the kind of longer term effect of the work that you're doing, that you're seeing? Are you seeing an impact, and is it trickling from the individual connections into more the systemic layers? Because one of my questions is that you guys are working a lot on very grassroots levels, alleviating suffering on that level, but it feels like a lot of the oppression and the problems are happening systemic governmental level. What do those things, do they meet, or is there
yeah, it's a, maybe we'll both flesh out an answer together. I mean, basically the political situation and the larger situation in Israel and Palestine is continuously getting worse. Politics are moving further to the right, becoming more and more heartless and uncaring. But what it offers people the opportunity to do is to choose not to participate in that. And so, in a certain way, there are quite a lot of people who are making that choice. And in any way that we can be a part of, kind of supporting people in making that choice, or coming afterwards and bringing people to meet those people, it's you know, like it really feels humbling to us to kind of come in with a group and introduce them to these people, and they feel so grateful that we've come and that we do what we do, and it feels so small and insignificant compared to what they're dedicating the whole life to. Yet it does bring them great support, and kind of having to recognize that. So it's very, very difficult to tell if we're getting closer to peace, because it's almost like it's getting darker and darker, and you keep kind of offering out light because that's just the right thing to do. And at a certain point, light dispels darkness, and it will. Like, eventually occupation will end, all walls must fall, they always have, you know, they need to be maintained. And that means that attitude that wants to maintain them, fear, delusion, and greed and aversion, have to be maintained, and eventually they can't be. You know, love will, like, overcome, and so the Dharma will succeed. And so it's very, very impossible from my perspective to tell, but there are certainly a lot of people out there with a lot of heart still willing to continue, and so that's kind of what inspires us, and that cycle of inspiration continues.
Yeah, I think, like, what's really interesting, has been really interesting for us in our journey, is to see that there's so many different groups that work in any field of activism, and we see it very clearly in this one, and they each have a place and a role, and they can be very different. And this is ours, and as the situation gets worse, it's impossible to say who's having an effect in the bigger picture, but the smaller picture is really important, and we really see it. Like, you were asking what the long-term effects are. In our relationship with the main village that we work with Duristia, which we've been working there since 2009, so it's actually only 7 years. It's not such a long time. But the effects have been astounding. When we first came, we were asked not to speak. The Israelis were asked not to speak Hebrew on the streets because they just didn't know, the people who were our hosts didn't know how people would react. And now when we drive in, kids that see Israeli cars wave, you know, because the perception has changed. An Israeli car is a friend, not an enemy. So that's really, really significant. The other really strong experience we had with that was on the last Being Peace retreat in October 2015, started a week after the recent wave of violence started, which is still going on. It's just less in the news, which consists mostly of young Palestinians trying to stab Israelis. But at that point, it was just the beginning, and no one knew what was going to happen. There was a lot of concern that it was going to blow up into something more violent. And we were just about to start the retreat, and we actually had planned to have a weekend with Israelis just before. So we were going to start Friday, Saturday, be there with a group of Israelis, and Sunday we were going to come with an international group. And we were in constant communication with our hosts in the village, and they constantly said to us, no, you can come, doesn't matter what happens, just come. And lots of people were saying to us, you know, you shouldn't go, aren't you afraid, you know, especially to me. You know, it's really, you don't know, I mean, most people in the village might be for you, but, like, someone might, whatever. And the thing was that the actual experience of being there was of overwhelming generosity and friendship, even more than before. So there was such an appreciation for people coming to be there. You know, the shopkeepers wouldn't let us pay for things in the shops. We walked down the street one day, and a car stopped. Someone we didn't know stopped, and he leaned over and he said to us, I know your faces. You come here every year to help, and I want you to know this is your home. You're always welcome here. You're always safe here. You know, just someone who to us was a stranger. So that kind of effect of, again, in Dharma language, like, really the metta overcoming the fear on both sides. And we don't know what's going to happen at the political level, but on the, it feels like on a very deep grassroots level, it has an effect also on Israelis that are coming. You know, we now have, on the Israeli side, we have people who came as individuals, then as couples, now they're bringing their kids, you know, so we've got really like young kids, 2-3 years old, that are coming and spending weekends in Palestine, and that's a, also a real transformation for them. Like their lives are going to be different as a result of that. Yeah, I hope that answers. I mean, it's a big question. Yeah, John, you had a question.
Oh, yeah, thanks. This is really inspiring and instructive. Playing the devil's advocate, sort of, how does the Buddhist stuff wash with the imams and the Palestinian?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, so it's essentially we kind of talk a different language in different circumstances, and we kind of just talk about meditation more than any kind of teachings in that field. But there are people very interested in the Indian traditions. I'm not sure about the imams themselves, but certainly what Zohar was mentioning, you know, asking international Dharma teachers to participate in organizing days in a very beautiful yoga center that we came across. And they wanted to bring more and more teachers. They practice in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition themselves. So there's kind of a general interest in what other teachings have to offer in addition to into the Muslim faith. But we also have friends who are very, very devoted to their deep understanding of the Muslim faith and what that has to offer for them. And of course meditation is a part of the Quran. And so and additionally we have some friends who are absolute meditation masters. I've no idea where they picked it up, but you know, he'll kind of disappear into a state. And one time we went out into the nature to a place, and he said, "We'll have a short meditation by this lake." And it started raining, and all the long-term Israeli meditation practitioners started to shuffle. And eventually I thought, well, I better ring the bell because, you know, people are getting wet. So I rang the bell, and we kind of got up, stood under umbrellas or put raincoats on. This friend, he was just sitting on the rock. I have a picture of Zohar holding an umbrella over him. He was just, you know, in his kind of bliss.
Is Sufism sort of going on there, or
it's not very predominant. But I mean, this friend that Nathan's talking about is a complete atheist.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
He's
yeah.
Palestinian Muslim but he's not practicing. But yeah, but most people are at least yeah. Yeah, but it hasn't been an issue because, like he said, we don't put Buddhism in the front of what we're doing. So it's a real deep
yeah.
kind of sense of Dharma rather than, and meditation rather than a religion. And yeah, and we do have both Christian, Muslim,
mm-hmm.
Palestinian friends who are real practitioners, and they bring it together somehow, which is very beautiful.
How do you approach like action that is not direct but is still important? Like I'm thinking, for example, some like background work that organizations do, like financial management, and these that they are not so motivating because they are not direct. Or another example would be like environmental activism, because also environment doesn't really have like face that you can see smiling if you did something for it. And it's more like abstract. I'm kind of further from the front.
Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to begin? Or me?
Yeah.
So, what becomes very important in any kind of action is obviously initially understanding our motivation, and in that sense, a little bit like when we come to meditation, we have a certain goal that we want to fulfill, and then recognizing what that skill is that we can kind of apply towards that goal. So as you say, you know, you might feel like, you know, I'm really good at juggling spreadsheets and this organization really needs that. And if we're willing to kind of tune into that and keep in contact with the heart of that organization, you know, so we're not just kind of shut off in a cupboard and we're just, you know, balancing numbers, and we still feel kind of involved, that can really make sure that that feeling of inspiration doesn't kind of wither off on its own, you know, because inspiration on its own isn't usually enough to get us all the way to the end. You know, we do need to see some kind of, not necessarily results, but certainly some kind of interactions. So it may be necessary to balance that up with field visits or interactions.
Mm.
And you give a really good example about the environment. So something that can really kind of support environmental action is also making sure that we get enough time in the environment, in nature. You know, because you know, we love being in nature. It feels sometimes like nature loves us being there as well. So if we're working for that connection, like maybe not doing all of that work indoors in the city kind of thing, or finding that way that you can support yourself. You know, and really not forgetting that it is the most valuable thing. You know, there is only one planet and we are making a mess of it. We do need that activism.
Mm.
So yeah,
yeah,
but
I think I was actually reading this recently. I think it's from Joanna Macy. That she was speaking about redefining success, which is a real resource, a real way of keeping us going when we're working with things that are very long term or kind of. So first of all, setting kind of smaller goals, and then redefining success. So success wouldn't necessarily be that we save the planet, but that we've had a meaningful interaction with somebody, or we had a, something like, or we feel, or we found some nourishment for our activism, or, you know, just kind of having a bit more creativity around what we're doing. But yeah, spending time in nature if you're doing environmental action. And also connecting to like-minded people. Again,
yeah.
Just like the practice, you know, that emphasis in Dharma teachings about Sangha. Really important to spend time with others that share your values and what's important to you. And all the pieces are important in action. It's not just the direct or the grassroots. You have to find where our skills are best used. Does that answer your question? It's a really good question.
Yeah, thank you.
So I really just want to echo that sense of the Sangha. I mean, basically our organisation, I don't know if it was thrown out in the publicity, is Sangha Seva. So Seva is the service, and the Sangha is this kind of community of like-minded people. And basically we kind of stumbled across this as being the essence of what brings that support, is actually having that Sangha. So as I was kind of saying in the beginning, making sure that you kind of check in with all parts of the organisation that's working. And so that, and it isn't always necessary that you stay in one part of it, you know, even if that is where your skill set leads you. You know, if it doesn't feel inspiring, it might be better to be in a different part of the organization as well. Even if it's your best skill, you know, if it's not fulfilling.
Any more questions? Comments? Yes.
I would have lots of questions because it's a very important topic for me, the link with activism and inner work.
Mm.
So first of all, thank you for bringing it up. I think it's mostly overlooked in spiritual circles, the role of action. And I work in animal rights, and it's a very hard area because there's a lot of indifference, because first of all, the subjects, they can't speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not enough empathy from humans. So I just wonder, how do you deal, because you mentioned it, and I was very glad that you mentioned the idea of burnout.
Mm.
So how do you deal with it, that you don't get like discouraged and just give up, because it's a massive task that it really, it's beyond the, the reality that it can change.
Mm.
You just need to think in terms of decades or even even longer periods of time. And just to put it into context, now it's even harder to deal with it because of the situation of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
There is some sense of urgency that you need to act, that you need to do it and now, otherwise, you know, there's not enough time. So how do you conceal the urgency and the being peace?
Mm.
How do you manage?
Mm.
Yeah.
Great question. They've all been great questions. Yeah. I start?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, what you're kind of bringing up, what you're pointing, that's actually like, if you asked a few questions in one, but they're all related. This sense of the amount of work that is to be done, like how much is to be done, and the kind of height of the mountains that need to be climbed, and that sense of that I was speaking of like being, how can I actually affect, or not seeing how my actions or my intentions are actually making a difference. And then that leading to burnout. And the sense of urgency as well, like if something doesn't happen soon, what are we gonna do? For me, I'll just speak personally. What really, really supports me is resting in the intention and the motivation, feeling the compassion and the care that this is coming from. And having trust in that, and also resting back into the complexity of life. Again, you know, what Dharma teachings are teaching us is that life is much more complicated than we can grasp. And so we have this tension sometimes between that sense of real care and urgency and seeing things that seem so clearly simple, you know, like the suffering of animals or the situation of the planet. Clearly simple, the action is very clear, and yet it's not happening. We have that sense of urgency, and we also equally have that sense of resting back into the complexity of life, that we are an essential part in the movement of change and transformation in our world, but we are, it's not completely up to us. You know, it's not completely up to me. And sometimes I can really feel it in the body. You know, the movement of urgency will be this, and then the resting back will be this, and still really present and really upright and ready and active, but kind of resting back. And sometimes I'm kind of have this kinetic sense of things. I feel like really like I'm plugging in to the interconnectedness, to the web of life that I'm a part of. And so that can really actually then give me energy and give me resources and give me support rather than depleting. And yeah, and holding lightly that wish to have results or certain results, kind of trusting that with the intention, with the presence, our actions are leading to results, but they're not necessarily leading to the results that we want to see ultimately and in the long term. You know, all these kind of images that we have of, like, in the past, people planting trees that would only bear fruit in their grandchildren's time. And, you know, we're doing, really important that we each do the best we can and the most we can with what we have. But it's not just on these shoulders to fix it all. And yeah, that can be a real resource and a real kind of like a perspective. Having a big view, equanimity, this quality of equanimity. You know, sometimes the word, the Pali word upekkha, one of the translations is, I forgot the one I want. There's a lot of translations and I love a lot of them. They're all running around my head. It basically is kind of to see over a distance, so to have perspective, so to see the wide view of things, that all these different actions, all these intentions that are coming together are creating something positive, but that we don't have the ability to really control in a very narrow way what will happen. And in that way also that thing that I said of setting smaller goals, you know, like changing to a plant-based diet ourselves reduces suffering in the world. That's really direct. Really direct. We've made a difference, and really also coming back to that, to seeing what we have done, what we are affecting, and not just what's still to do. That kind of. Yeah. Does that
meet
mm-hmm. you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to add anything?
Yes, I think a few things that come to mind. You know, is even just as you ask this question. You know, you're helping make that change. You know, you're bringing that topic into this field of awareness. For some people, it might be new, might be a fresh way of looking. So there are so many moments when we're, you know, kind of spreading our message, and we never get to know. You know, we don't necessarily get feedback on everything that we do, and just kind of staying open to that. You know, your T-shirt's giving a message. It's like, it's really great. You know, that you're doing this. And you're participating in it, and you're doing it heartfelt, and that genuineness really matters as well. And of course, the price for all of that is that risk of burnout. You know, it is participating in that risk. And in a certain sense, we have to be making that risk for burnout. You know, that's what dedication is kind of about. So that means that we also have to include that possibility in our day-to-day reflection. Like it's really good if we have a meditation practice that each day we just kind of check in the body, like, what am I holding on to? How am I feeling? You know, is this stress? Am I stressed? What can I do about that? You know, what can I do about that? How can I remain open to life? How can I, you know, so really including that possibility in life, because it's really likely, if you're going against the flow, if you're going against the stream, it's really, really likely that you're going to feel alienated, or, you know, that heightened stress that we call burnout. And so again, you know, as much as possible, having like-minded people, but also finding those opportunities to meet with others, and that kind of balance between having a close sangha who see the same way as we do and feel the same way as we do and want to do things together, but also looking for those opportunities to awaken it in other people, because that's what essentially you're trying to do. And finding that methodology, like Zara was speaking about in her part of the talk, that methodology that others can hear, right? Nobody likes being criticized. So just watching out how my ethics automatically criticize someone else's. Automatically, as I say I care about animals, I'm automatically implying someone who does something other than me doesn't care about animals. And that can be a very difficult thing to hear, you know, so finding the positivity in that helps to make the change as well. So it's just a couple of thoughts for me.
Yeah, and definitely taking time to practice. For me, I find like with a lot of these build-ups, compassion, equanimity practices really help to just really kind of let go of what kind of is stuck to me or what I'm holding on to. Yeah, to free up the energies. Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Maybe we can just do one more.
I'm involved in anti-racist work, and I know a lot of people who have the same goal as me, but they, oftentimes I find it that the most important thing for them is to find enemies, and I find myself alone in trying to find compassion. I don't really have a question, but just a comment that Or maybe you have experience of that.
I guess what like the voice that you're raising is actually how important it is that that people like us who do have a spiritual practice and do you know, prioritize compassion and non-separation come more into the realms of activism. To have more voices like that actually are interested in seeing the bigger picture and that differentiate between, and I think this is a helpful thing to kind of also suggest to people, is to differentiate between bad actions or harmful views and bad people. You know, it's really is helpful to have that. And it's a real issue in our world. I mean, it came up right from the beginning that many times, and that also is actually what keeps a lot of us out of the away from these areas of action for change because of the kind of energy that's often there.
Yeah. You know, it's obviously complex working with other people, even when we really see eye to eye on really kind of core issues. One or two kind of things that we can look for in other people that can kind of help with those relationships as we work together on something is really feeling that connection to the other people, you know, really recognizing that they're, you know, if they're working for free, you know, they're putting their free time into this, you know, even if they're working for money, this is what they're choosing to do with their life, their precious life. You know, no life is actually worth any amount of money. No amount of your time is worth any amount of money. It's what you want to be doing with your life. And so really trying to see the positivity so that when you meet them, you're kind of coming from that positivity angle, and then you can kind of generate the opportunities for then finding that balance of also making minor criticisms in a certain sense of, like, you know, I feel like as an organization, we're moving too much in this direction. We're not, you know, addressing the core issues of this. And then so kind of suggesting what become your core issues that are coming from your practice or whatever into that arena, and then just continuously offering them without, you know, the expectation that they'll be taken up. So it's a difficult work, you know, and again it does risk that element of burnout, you know, or even a risk of alienation. But if the organization itself doesn't want to transform into that direction, then maybe a new organization is necessary. And from the very beginning, you need to make clear definition of what it is that's important to you. That as we work for anti-racism, right, we're working for unity. And if and in the anti of anti-racism starts to imply the difficulty that we might come up against, you know, that there are going to be those racists who are never going to change. You know, so we're making sure that we're really clear about it's not about people. It's about their actions. And people can change, right? They're not a fixed thing. That action is that action. That was a racist action. So making sure it's a definition of actions and not people as well. So that we don't, you know, pin people down, give them a life sentence. It's something we do for ourselves as well in practice. You know, we define ourselves as something. Small things like bad meditator, but sometimes really big things. So just watching out for those definitions and those boxes.
So maybe we'll just have a couple of minutes of silence and then we'll close with the practical things. So just taking time to ground into the body. See if we can make space for whatever impact there is from this time together. benefits of this time together be shared, be for the welfare, the well-being of all beings everywhere.